the edge. A figure appeared on the sill. It was Jack. Her heart beat so loudly she could hear it. "What are you doing?" he said warily.
I was seeing how your cathedral is coming along."
He pointed to the capital above her head. "I did that." She looked up. The stone was carved with the figure of a man who appeared to be holding the weight of the arch on his back. His body was twisted as if in pain. Aliena stared at it. She had never seen anything quite like it. Without thinking, she said, "That's how I feel." When she looked back at him, he was beside her, holding her arm gently but firmly. "I know," he said. She looked at the drop. The thought of falling all that way made her sick with fear. He tugged at her arm. She allowed herself to be led into the clerestory passage. They went all the way down the turret stairs and came out on the ground. Aliena felt weak. Jack turned to her and said in a conversational tone, "I was reading in the cloisters and looked up and saw you in the clerestory." She looked at his young face, so full of concern and tenderness. And she remembered why she had run away from everyone else and sought solitude here. She yearned to kiss him, and she saw the answering longing in his eyes. Every fibre of her body told her to throw herself into his arms, but she knew what she had to do. She wanted to say, "I love you," like a thunderstorm, like a lion, like a helpless rage. But instead she said, "I think I'm going to marry Alfred." He stared at her. He looked stunned. Then his face became sad with an old, wise sadness that was beyond his years. She thought he was going to cry, but he did not. Instead, there was anger in his eyes. He opened his mouth to speak, changed his mind, hesitated, then spoke at last. In a voice like the cold north wind, he said, "You would have done better to jump off the clerestory." He turned from her and walked back into the monastery. "I've lost him forever," Aliena thought, and she felt as if her heart would break. 2. Jack was seen sneaking out of the monastery on Lammas Day. It was not a serious offence in itself, but he had been caught several times before, and the fact that this time he had gone out to speak to an unmarried woman made the whole thing more grave. His transgression was discussed in chapter the following day, and he was ordered to be kept in close confinement. That meant he was restricted to the monastic buildings, the cloisters and the crypt, and any time that he went from one building to another he had to be accompanied. He hardly noticed. He was so devastated by Aliena's announcement that nothing else made much difference. If he had been flogged instead of just confined, he felt, he would have been equally oblivious. There was now no question of his working on the cathedral, of course, but much of the pleasure had gone out of that since Alfred had taken charge. Now he spent the free afternoons reading. His Latin had improved by leaps and bounds, and he could read anything, albeit slowly. And as he was supposed to be reading to improve his Latin, rather than for any other purpose, he was allowed to use any book that took his fancy. Small though the library was, it had several works of philosophy and mathematics, and Jack had plunged into them with enthusiasm. Much of what he read was disappointing. There were pages of genealogies, repetitive accounts of miracles performed by long-dead saints, and endless theological speculation. The first book that really appealed to Jack told the whole history of the world, from the creation to the founding of Kingsbridge Priory, and when he finished it, he felt he knew everything that had ever happened. He realized after a while that the book's claim to tell all events was implausible, for after all, things were going on everywhere all the time, not just in Kingsbridge and England, but in Normandy, Anjou, Paris, Rome, Ethiopia, and Jerusalem, so the author must have left out a lot. Nevertheless, the book gave Jack a feeling he had never had before, that the past was like a story, in which one thing led to another, and the world was not a boundless mystery, but a finite thing that could be comprehended. Even more intriguing were the puzzles. One philosopher asked why a weak man can move a heavy stone with a lever. This had never seemed strange to Jack before, but now the question tormented him. He had spent several weeks at the quarry at one time, and he recalled that when a stone could not be moved with a crowbar a foot long, the solution was generally to use a crowbar 2 feet long. Why should the same man be unable to move the stone with a short lever, yet able to move it with a long one? That question led to others. The cathedral builders used a huge winding wheel to lift large stones and timbers up to the roof. The load at the end of the rope was much too heavy for a man to lift with his hands, but the same man could turn the wheel that wound the rope, and the load would rise. How was that possible? Such speculations distracted him for a while, but his thoughts returned again and again to Aliena. He would stand in the cloisters with a heavy book on a lectern in front of him, and recall that morning in the old mill when he had kissed her. He could remember every instant of that kiss, from the first soft touch of lips to the thrilling sensation of her tongue in his mouth. His body had pressed hers from thighs to shoulders, so that he could feel the contours of her breasts and her hips. The memory was so intense that it was like experiencing it all over again. Why had she changed? He still believed that the kiss was real and her subsequent coldness was false. He felt he knew her. She was loving, sensual, romantic, imaginative, and warm. She was also thoughtless and imperious, and she had learned to be tough. But she was not cold, not cruel, not heartless. It was not in character for her to marry for money a man she did not love. She would be unhappy. She would regret it. She would be sick with misery. He knew it, and in her heart she must know it too. One day when he was in the writing room, a priory servant who was sweeping the floor stopped for a rest, leaned on his broom and said, "Big celebration coming up in your family, then." Jack was studying a map of the world, drawn on a big sheet of vellum. He looked up. The speaker was an gnarled old man, too feeble now for heavy work. He probably had Jack confused with someone else. "Why is that, Joseph?"
"Didn't you know? Your brother's getting married."
"I have no brothers," Jack said automatically, but his heart had gone cold.
"Step-brother, then," said Joseph.
"No, I didn't know." Jack had to ask the question. He gritted his teeth.
"Who is he marrying?"
"That's Aliena."
So she was determined to go through with it. Jack had been harboring a secret hope that she would change her mind. He looked away so that Joseph should not see the despair on his face. "Well, well," he said, trying to make his voice sound unemotional.
"Yes, her that used to be so high and mighty until she lost everything in the fire."
Did you say when?"
"Tomorrow. They're going to get wed in the new parish church Alfred built."
Tomorrow. Aliena was going to marry Alfred tomorrow. Until now, Jack had never really believed it would happen. Now the reality burst on him like a thunderclap. Aliena was going to get married tomorrow. Jack's life would end tomorrow. He looked down at the map on the lectern in front of him. What did it matter whether the center of the world was Jerusalem or Wallingford? Would he be happier if he knew how levers worked? He had told Aliena that she should jump from the clerestory rather than marry Alfred. What he should have said was that he, Jack, might as well jump from the clerestory. He despised the priory. Being a monk was a stupid way of life. If he could not work on the cathedral and Aliena married someone else, he had nothing to live for. What made it worse was that he knew how thoroughly miserable she would be living with Alfred. This was not just because he hated Alfred. There were some girls who might be more or less contented married to Alfred. For example, Edith, the one who had giggled when Jack talked to her about how he loved to carve stone. Edith would not expect much of Alfred, and she would be glad to flatter him and obey him as long as he continued prosperous and loved their children. But Aliena would hate every minute. She would loathe Alfred's physical coarseness. She would despise him for his bullying ways. She would be disgusted by his meanness, and she would find his slow-wittedness maddening. Marriage to Alfred would be hell for her. Why could she not see that? Jack was mystified. What was going on in her mind? Surely anything would be better than marriage to a man she did not love. She had caused a sensation by refusing to marry William Hamley 7 years ago, yet now she had passively accepted a proposal from someone equally unsuitable. What was she thinking of? Jack had to know. He had to talk to her, and to hell with the monastery. He rolled up the map, replaced it in the cupboard, and went to the door. Joseph was still leaning on his broomstick.
"Are you leaving?" he said to Jack. "I thought you were supposed to stay here until the circuiter comes for you." "The circuiter can go shit," said Jack, and he stepped out.
As he emerged into the east walk of the cloisters, he caught the eye of Prior Philip, who was coming in from the building site to the north. Jack turned away quickly, but Philip called out, "Jack, what are you doing? You're supposed to be confined."
Jack had no patience for monastic discipline now. He ignored Philip and walked the other way, heading for the passage that led from the south walk down to the small houses around the new quay. But his luck was out. At that moment, Brother Pierre, the circuiter, came out of the passage, followed by his two deputies. They saw Jack and stopped dead. A look of astonished indignation spread over Pierre's moon-shaped face.
Philip called out, "Stop that novice, Brother Circuiter!"
Pierre held out a hand to stop Jack. Jack pushed him aside. Pierre reddened and grabbed at Jack's arm. Jack wrenched his arm free and punched Pierre on the nose. Pierre gave a shout, more of outrage than pain. Then his two deputies jumped on Jack. Jack struggled like a maniac and almost got free, but when Pierre recovered from the blow to his nose and joined in, the three of them were able to wrestle Jack to the ground and hold him there. He continued to wriggle, furious that this monastic horseshit was now keeping him from something really important, speaking to Aliena. He kept saying, "Let me go, you stupid fools!" The two deputies sat on him. Pierre stood upright, wiping his bleeding nose on the sleeve of his habit. Philip appeared beside him. Despite his own rage, Jack could see that Philip, too, was angry, angrier than Jack had ever seen him.
"I will not tolerate this behavior from anyone," he said in a voice like iron. "You're a novice monk, and you will obey me."
He turned to Pierre. "Put him in the obedience room."
"No," Jack shouted. "You can't!"
"I most certainly can," Philip said wrathfully. The obedience room was a small windowless cell in the undercroft beneath the dormitory at the south end next to the latrines. It was mainly used to imprison lawbreakers who were waiting to be dealt with at the prior's court, or to be transferred to the sheriff's jail at Shiring. But it did occasional service as a punishment cell for monks who committed serious disciplinary offences, such as acts of impurity with priory servants. It was not the solitary confinement that scared Jack. It was the fact that he would not be able to get out to see Aliena.
"You don't understand," he yelled at Philip. "I have to speak to Aliena."
It was the worst thing he could have said. Philip got angrier.
"It was for speaking to her that you were originally punished," he said furiously. "But I must. The only thing you must do is learn to fear God and obey your superiors."
"You're not my superior, you silly ass. You're nothing to me. Let me go, damn you all!"
"Take him away," Philip said grimly.
A little crowd had gathered by now, and several monks lifted Jack by his arms and legs. He wriggled like a fish on a hook, but there were too many of them. He could not believe that this was happening. They carried him, kicking and struggling, along the passage to the door of the obedience room. Someone opened it. Brother Pierre's voice said vengefully, "Throw him in!" They swung him back, and he was hurled through the air. He landed in a heap on the stone floor. He scrambled to his feet, numb to his bruises, and rushed at the door, but it slammed just as he crashed into it, and a moment later the heavy iron bar thudded down outside, and the key turned in the lock. Jack hammered on the door with all his might.
"Let me out!"
he yelled hysterically.
"I have to stop her from marrying him. Let me out!"
There was no sound from outside. He kept on calling, but his demands turned into pleas, and his voice dropped into a whine, then eventually to a whisper, and he wept tears of frustrated rage. At last his eyes dried up, and he could cry no more. He turned from the door. The cell was not quite pitch black. A little light came under the door, and he could make out his surroundings vaguely. He went around the walls, feeling with his hands. He could tell by the pattern of chisel marks on the stones that the cell had been built a long time ago. The room was almost featureless. It was about 6 feet square, with a column in one corner and an upward-arching ceiling. Clearly, it had once been part of a larger room, and had been walled off for use as a prison. In one wall there was a space like an opening for a slit window, but it was tightly shuttered, and would have been too small for anyone to crawl through even if it had been open. The stone floor felt damp. Jack became aware of a constant rushing noise, and realized that the water channel which ran through the priory from the mill pond to the latrines must pass beneath the cell. That would explain why the floor was of stone instead of beaten earth. He felt drained. He sat on the floor with his back to the wall and stared at the crack of light under the door, the tantalizing reminder of where he wanted to be. How had he got into this fix? He had never believed in the monastery, never intended to dedicate his life to God. He did not really believe in God. He had become a novice as a solution to an immediate problem, a way of staying in Kingsbridge, close to what he loved. He had thought, I can always leave if I want to. But now he did want to leave, wanted to more than he had ever imagined. And he could not. He was a prisoner. I'll strangle Prior Philip as soon as I get out of here, he thought, even if I have to hang for it afterward. That started him wondering when he would be released. He heard the bell ring for supper. They certainly intended to leave him here all night. They were probably discussing him right now. The worst of the monks would argue that he should be shut up for a week. He could just see Pierre and Remigius calling for firm discipline. Others who liked him might say one night was sufficient punishment. What would Philip say? He liked Jack, but he would be terribly angry now, especially after Jack had said, "You're not my superior, you silly ass. You're nothing to me." Philip would be tempted to let the hardliners have their own way. The only hope was that they might want Jack thrown out of the monastery immediately, which, in their view, would be a harsher sentence. That way he might be able to speak to her before the wedding. But Philip would be against that, Jack was sure. Philip would see expelling Jack as an admission of defeat. The light under the door was growing fainter. It was getting dark outside. Jack wondered how prisoners were supposed to relieve themselves. There was no pot in the cell. It would not be characteristic of the monks to overlook that particular detail. They believed in cleanliness, even for sinners. He inspected the floor again, inch by inch, and found a small hole close to one corner. The noise of water was louder there, and he guessed it led to the underground channel. This was presumably his latrine. Shortly after he made this discovery, the small shutter opened. Jack sprang to his feet. A bowl and a crust of bread were placed on the sill. Jack could not see the face of the man who put them there. "Who's that?" he said. "I am not permitted to converse with you," the man said in a monotone. However, Jack recognized the voice. It was an old monk called Luke. "Luke, have they said how long I have to stay in here?" Jack cried. He repeated the formula. "I am not permitted to converse with you." "Please, Luke, tell me if you know," Jack pleaded, not caring how pathetic he might sound. Luke replied in a whisper, "Pierre said a week, but Philip made it 2 days." The shutter slammed. 2 days, Jack said desperately. "But she'll be married by then." There was no reply. Jack stood still, staring at nothing. The light coming through the slit had been strong by comparison with the near dark inside, and he could not see for a few moments until his sight readjusted to the gloom. Then his eyes filled with new tears, and he was blind again. He lay down on the floor. There was nothing more to be done. He was locked in here until Monday, and by Monday Aliena would be Alfred's wife, waking up in Alfred's bed, with Alfred's seed inside her. The thought nauseated him. Soon it was pitch black. He fumbled his way to the sill and drank from the bowl. It contained plain water. He took a small piece of bread and put it in his mouth, but he was not hungry and he could hardly swallow it. He drank the rest of the water and lay down again. He did not sleep, but he went into a kind of doze, almost like a trance, in which he relived, as in a dream or a vision, the Sunday afternoons he had spent with Aliena last summer, when he had told her the story of the squire who loved the princess, and went in search of the vine that bore jewels. The midnight bell brought him out of the doze. He was used to the monastic timetable now, and he felt wide awake at midnight, though he often needed to sleep in the afternoons, especially if there had been meat for dinner. The monks would be getting out of their beds and forming up in lines for the procession from dormitory to church. They were immediately above Jack, but he could hear nothing. The cell was soundproof. It seemed, very soon afterward, that the bell rang again for Lourdes, which took place an hour after midnight. Time was passing quickly, too quickly, for tomorrow Aliena would be married. In the small hours, despite his misery, he fell asleep. He came awake with a start. There was someone in the cell with him. He was terrified. The cell was pitch black. The sound of water seemed louder. "Who is it?" he said in a trembling voice.
"It's me. Don't be afraid."
"Mother!" He almost fainted with relief. "How did you know I was in here?" "Old Joseph came to tell me what had happened," she replied in a normal voice. "Quiet. The monks will hear you."
"No, they won't.
You can sing and shout in here without being heard above."
"I know. I've done it."
His head was so full of questions that he did not know which to ask first. "How did you get in here? Is the door open?" He moved toward her, holding his hands out in front of him.
"Oh, you're wet."
"The water channel runs right under here. There's a loose stone in the floor."
"How did you know that?"
"Your father spent 10 months in this cell," she said, and in her voice there was the bitterness of years.
"My father? This cell? 10 months?
That's when he taught me all those stories."
"But why was he in here?"
"We never found out," she said resentfully. "He was kidnapped or arrested, he never knew which, in Normandy, and he was brought here. He didn't speak English or Latin, and he had no idea where he was. He worked in the stables for a year or so. That's how I met him." Her voice softened with nostalgia. "I loved him from the moment I set eyes on him. He was so gentle, and he looked so frightened and unhappy, yet he sang like a bird. Nobody had spoken to him for months. He was so pleased when I said a few words in French. I think he fell in love with me just for that." Anger made her voice hard again. "After a while, they put him in this cell. That's when I discovered how to get in here." It occurred to Jack that he must have been conceived right here on the cold stone floor. The thought embarrassed him, and he was glad it was too dark for him and his mother to see each other. He said, "But my father must have done something to be arrested like that." "He couldn't think of anything, and in the end they invented a crime. Someone gave him a jeweled cup and told him he could go. A mile or two away he was arrested and accused of stealing the cup. They hanged him for it." She was crying.
"Who did all this?"
"The Sheriff of Shiring? The Prior of Kingsbridge?" "It doesn't matter who."
"What about my father's family? He must have had parents, brothers and sisters."
"Yes, he had a big family. Back in France." "Why didn't he escape and go back there?" "He tried, once, and they caught him and brought him back. That was when they put him in the cell. He could have tried again, of course, once we had found out how to get out of here. But he didn't know the way home, he couldn't speak a word of English, and he was penniless. His chances were slim. He should have done it anyway, we know now. But at the time we never thought they'd hang him." Jack put his arms around her to comfort her. She was soaking wet and shivering. She needed to get out of here and get dry. He realized with a shock that if she could get out, so could he. For a few moments he had almost forgotten about Aliena, as his mother talked about his father. But now he realized that his wish had been granted. He could speak to Aliena before her wedding.
"Show me the way out," he said abruptly.
She sniffed and swallowed her tears.
"Hold my arm, and I'll lead you."
They moved across the cell, and then he felt her go down.
"Just lower yourself into the channel," she said. "Take a deep breath and put your head under, then crawl against the flow. Don't go with the flow, or you'll end up in the monk's latrine. You'll get short of breath when you're almost there, but just keep calm and crawl on, and you'll make it. She went lower still, and he lost contact. He found the hole and eased himself down. His feet touched the water almost immediately. When he stood on the bottom of the channel, his shoulders were still in the cell. Before lowering himself farther, he found the stone and replaced it in position, thinking mischievously that the monks would be mystified when they found the cell empty. The water was cold. He took a deep breath, went down on his hands and knees, and crawled against the flow. He went as fast as he could. As he crawled, he pictured the buildings above him. He was going beneath the passageway, then the refectory, the kitchen and the bakehouse. It was not far, but it seemed to take forever. He tried to surface but banged his head on the roof of the tunnel. He felt panicky and remembered what his mother had said. He was almost there. A few moments later he saw light ahead of him. Dawn must have broken while they were talking in the cell. He crawled until the light was above him. Then he stood upright and gasped the fresh air gratefully. When he had got his breath back, he climbed out of the ditch. His mother had changed her clothes. She was wearing a clean, dry dress and wringing out the wet one. She had brought dry clothes for him, too. There, in a neat pile on the bank, were the garments he had not worn for half a year. A linen shirt, a green wool tunic, grey hose and leather boots. Mother turned her back, and Jack threw off the heavy monastic robe, stepped out of the sandals, and quickly dressed in his own clothes. He threw the monk's habit into the ditch. He was never going to wear it again. "What will you do now?" Mother asked. "Go to Aliena. Right away. It's early. I can't wait." She nodded. "Be gentle. She's bruised." Jack stooped to kiss her, then impulsively threw his arms around her and hugged her. "You got me out of a prison," he said, and he laughed. "What a mother!" She smiled, but her eyes were moist. He gave her a farewell squeeze and walked away. Even though it was now full light, there was nobody about because it was Sunday and people did not have to work, so they took the opportunity to sleep past sunrise. Jack was not sure whether he should be afraid of being seen. Did Prior Philip have the right to come after a runaway novice and force him to return? Even if he had that right, would he want to? Jack did not know. However, Philip was the law in Kingsbridge, and Jack had defied him, so there was bound to be trouble of some kind. However, Jack was looking no farther ahead than the next few moments. He reached Aliena's little house. It occurred to him that Richard might be there. He hoped not. However, there was nothing he could do about it. He went up to the door and tapped on it gently. He cocked his head and listened. Nothing moved inside. He tapped again, harder, and this time he was rewarded by the sound of rustling straw as someone moved. "Aliena!" he said in a loud whisper. He heard her come to the door. A frightened voice said, "Yes? Open the door! Who is it? It's Jack!" "Jack!" There was a pause. Jack waited. Aliena closed her eyes in despair and slumped forward, leaning against the door with her cheek on the rough woodwork. "Not Jack," she thought. "Not today, not now." His voice came again, a low, urgent whisper. "Aliena, please open the door quickly. If they catch me, they'll put me back in the cell." She had heard that he had been locked up. It was all over town. Obviously, he had escaped, and he had come straight to her. Her heart quickened. She could not turn him away. She lifted the bar and opened the door. His red hair was plastered wetly to his head, as if he had bathed. He was wearing ordinary clothes, not his monk's habit. He smiled at her as if seeing her was the best thing that had ever happened to him. Then he frowned and said, "You've been crying." "Why have you come here?" she said. "I had to see you. I'm getting married today." "I know. Can I come in?" It would be wrong to let him in, she knew. But then it occurred to her that tomorrow she would be Alfred's wife, so this might be the last time she would ever talk to Jack alone. She thought, "I don't care if it is wrong." She opened the door wider, Jack stepped in, and she closed it again and replaced the bar. They stood facing one another. Now she felt embarrassed. He stared at her with desperate longing as a man dying of thirst might gaze at a waterfall.
Don't look at me like that, she said, and she turned away.
Don't marry him, Jack said. I must. You'll be miserable.
I'm miserable now.
Look at me, please.
She turned to face him and raised her eyes.
Please tell me why you're doing this, he said.
Why should I?
Because of the way you kissed me in the old mill.
She dropped her gaze and felt herself blush hotly. She had let herself down that day, and had been ashamed of herself ever since. Now he was using it against her. She said nothing. She had no defense.
He said, after that, you turned cold.
She kept her gaze lowered.
We were such friends,
he went on remorselessly, all that summer in your glade by the waterfall.
My stories. We were so happy.
I kissed you there once.
Do you remember?
She did remember, of course, although she had been pretending to herself that it never happened. Now the memory melted her heart, and she looked at him with tearful eyes.
Then I made the mill do your felting, he said. I was so pleased that I could help you in your business. You were thrilled when you saw it.
Then we kissed again, but that wasn't a little kiss like the first one. This time it was passionate.
Oh, God. Yes, it was, she thought. And she blushed again and began to breathe fast, and wished he would stop. But he would not. We held each other very tight. We kissed for a long time.
You opened your mouth. Stop! She cried.
Why? He said brutally. What's wrong with it? Why did you turn cold?
Because I'm frightened, she said without thinking.
And she burst into tears. She buried her face in her hands and sobbed. A moment later, she felt his hands on her heaving shoulders. She did nothing, and after a while he gently enfolded her in his arms. She took her hands from her face and cried on his green tunic. After a while, she put her arms around his waist. He laid his cheek on her hair, her ugly, short, shapeless hair, not yet grown back after the fire, and stroked her back as if she were a baby. She wanted to stay like that forever, but he pulled away from her so that he could look at her, and he said, "Why does it make you frightened?" She knew, but she could not tell him. She shook her head and took a step back, but he held her wrists, keeping her near.
"Listen, Aliena," he said, "I want you to know how terrible this has been for me. You seemed to love me, then you seemed to hate me, and now you're going to marry my stepbrother. I don't understand. I don't know anything about these things. I've never been in love before. It's all so hurtful. I can't find words for how bad it is. Don't you think you should at least try to explain to me why I have to go through this?"
She felt full of remorse. To think that she had hurt him so badly when she loved him so much. She was ashamed of the way she had treated him. He had done nothing but kind things to her, and she had ruined his life. He was entitled to an explanation. She steeled herself.
"Jack, something happened to me a long time ago. Something truly awful. Something I've made myself forget for years. I wanted never to think of it again. But when you kissed me like that, it all came back to me, and I couldn't stand it."
"What was it? What was the thing that happened?"
"After my father was imprisoned, we lived in the castle, Richard and I, and a servant called Matthew. And one night William Hamley came and threw us out."
He narrowed his eyes.
"And?"
"They killed poor Matthew." He knew she was not telling him the whole truth.
"Why?"
"What do you mean?
Why did they kill your servant?"
"Because he was trying to stop them."
Tears were streaming down her face now, and her throat felt constricted every time she tried to speak, as if the words were choking her. She shook her head helplessly and tried to turn away, but Jack would not let her go. In a voice as gentle as a kiss, he said,
"Stop them from doing what?"
Suddenly she knew she could tell him, and it all came out in a rush.
"They forced me," she said. "The groom held me down, and William got on top of me. But still I wouldn't let him. And then they cut off a piece of Richard's ear, and they said they would cut him more."
She was sobbing with relief now, grateful beyond expression that at last she could say it. She looked into Jack's eyes and said,
"So I opened my legs, and William did it to me.
while the groom forced Richard to watch.
"I'm so sorry," Jack whispered. "I heard rumors, but I never thought."
"Dear Aliena,
how could they?"
She had to tell him everything.
"Then, when William had done it to me, the groom did it too."
Jack closed his eyes. His face was white and taut. Aliena said,
"And then, you see, when you and I kissed, I wanted you to do it, and that made me think of William and his groom, and I felt so horrible and frightened, and I ran away. That's why I was so mean to you, and made you miserable. I'm sorry."
"I forgive you,"
he whispered. He drew her to him, and she let him put his arms around her again. It was so comforting.
She felt him shudder. Anxiously, she said, "Do I disgust you?"
He looked at her. "I adore you," he said. He bent his head and kissed her mouth. She froze. This was not what she wanted. He pulled away a little, then kissed her again. The touch of his lips on hers was very soft. Feeling grateful and friendly toward him, she pursed her lips just a little, then relaxed them again in a faint echo of his kiss. Encouraged, he moved his lips against hers again. She could feel his breath warm on her face. He opened his mouth a fraction. She pulled away quickly. He looked hurt. Is it that bad? In truth, she was no longer as frightened as she had been. She had told him the horrible truth about herself, and he had not recoiled in disgust. In fact, he was as tender and kind as ever. She tilted her head, and he kissed her again. This was not scary. There was nothing threatening, nothing violently uncontrollable, no force or hatred or dominance, just the reverse. This kiss was a shared pleasure. His lips parted, and she felt the tip of his tongue. She went taut. He teased her lips apart. She relaxed again. He sucked gently at her lower lip. She felt a little dizzy. He said, "Would you do what you did last time?"
"What did I do?"
"I'll show you. Open your mouth just a little."
She did as he said, and she felt his tongue again, touching her lips, passing between her parted teeth, and probing into her mouth until he found her own tongue. She pulled away.
"There,"
he said, "that's what you did."
"Did I?"
She was shocked.
"Yes." He smiled, then suddenly he looked solemn. "If you would only do it again, that would make up for all the sorrow of the last 9 months."
She tilted her face again and closed her eyes. After a moment she felt his mouth on hers. She opened her lips, hesitated, then nervously pushed her tongue into his mouth. As she did so, she remembered how she had felt the last time she did it in the old mill, and that ecstatic sensation came back. She was filled with the need to hold him, to touch his skin and his hair, to feel his muscles and his bones, to be inside him and have him inside her. Her tongue met his, and instead of feeling embarrassed and faintly repelled, she was thrilled to be doing something so intimate as touching his tongue with her own. They were both breathing hard now. Jack held her head in his hands. She stroked his arms, his back, and then his hips, feeling the taut, bunched muscles. Her heart pounded in her chest. At last she broke the kiss, breathless. She looked at him. He was flushed and panting, and his face shone with desire. After a moment he bent forward again, but instead of kissing her mouth, he lifted her chin and kissed the delicate skin of her throat. She heard herself moan with pleasure. He moved his head lower and brushed his lips over the swell of her breast. Her nipples were swollen under the coarse fabric of the linen nightshirt, and they felt unbearably tender. His lips closed over one nipple. She felt the heat of his breath on her skin.
"Gently,"
she whispered fearfully. He kissed her nipple through the linen, and although he was as gentle as could be, she felt a sensation of pleasure as sharp as if he had bitten her, and she gasped. Then he went down on his knees in front of her. He pressed his face into her lap. Until this moment, all the sensation had been in her breasts, but now, suddenly, she felt the tingling move to her groin. He found the hem of her nightshirt and lifted it to her waist. She watched him, afraid of his reaction. She had always felt ashamed of being so hairy down there. but he was not repelled. In fact, he leaned forward and kissed her gently right there, as if it was the nicest thing in the world. She sank down on her knees in front of him. Her breath came in gasps now, as if she had run a mile. She wanted him badly. Her throat was dry with desire. She put her hands on his knees, then slid one hand under his tunic. She had never touched a man's cock. It was hot and dry and hard as a board. Jack closed his eyes and groaned deep in his throat as she explored its length with her fingertips. She lifted his tunic, bent down and kissed it, just as he had kissed her, a gentle brush of the lips. Its end was swollen, tight as a drum, and wet with some kind of moisture. She was suddenly possessed by a desire to show him her breasts. She came upright again. He opened his eyes. Watching him, she quickly pulled her nightshirt over her head and discarded it. Now she was completely naked. She felt sharply self-conscious, but it was a good feeling, delightfully indecent. Jack stared, mesmerized, at her breasts. "They're so beautiful," he said. "Do you really think so?" she said. "I always thought they were too big." "Too big?" he said, as if the suggestion were outrageous. He reached out and touched her left breast with his right hand. He stroked her skin gently with his fingertips. She looked down, watching what he was doing. After a while, she wanted him to be firmer. She took both his hands in hers and pressed them to her breasts. "Do it harder," she said hoarsely. "I want to feel you more." Her words inflamed him. He squeezed her breasts, then took her nipples in his fingers and pinched them, just hard enough to hurt a little. The sensation drove her wild. All thought went out of her mind, and she was completely possessed by the feel of his body and her own. "Take off your clothes," she said. "I want to look at you." He pulled off his tunic and his undershirt, his boots and his hose, and knelt in front of her again. His red hair was drying into undisciplined curls. His body was thin and white with bony shoulders and hips. He looked wiry and agile, young and fresh. His cock stuck up like a tree out of the auburn hair of his groin. Suddenly she wanted to kiss his chest. She leaned forward and brushed her lips across his flat male nipples. They puckered, just as hers had. She sucked at them gently, wanting him to have the same pleasure he had given her. He stroked her hair. She wanted him inside her, quickly. She could see that he was not sure what to do next. "Jack," she said, "are you a virgin?" He nodded, looking a little foolish. "I'm glad," she said fervently. "I'm so glad." She took his hand and put it between her legs. She was swollen and sensitive there, and his touch was like a shock. "Feel me," she said. He moved his fingers, exploring. "Feel inside," she said. Hesitantly, he pushed a finger inside her. She was slippery with desire. "There," she said with a sigh of satisfaction. "That's where it has to go." She detached his hand and lay back in the straw. He lay over her, supporting himself on one elbow, and kissed her mouth. She felt him enter her a little way, then stop. "What is it?" she said. "It feels too small," he said. "I'm afraid of hurting you." "Push harder," she said. "I want you so much I don't care if it hurts." She felt him push. It did hurt more than she had expected, but only for a moment, and then she felt wonderfully filled. She looked at him. He withdrew a little and pushed again, and she pushed back. She smiled at him. "I never knew it was so nice," she said wonderingly. He closed his eyes as if the happiness was too much to bear. He began to move rhythmically. The constant stroke set up a pulse of pleasure somewhere in her groin. She heard herself give little gasps of excitement every time their bodies came together. He lowered himself so that his chest was touching her nipples, and she could feel his hot breath. She dug her fingers into his hard back. Her regular gasps turned into cries. Suddenly she needed to kiss him. She buried her hands in his curls and pulled his head to hers. She kissed his lips hard, then thrust her tongue into his mouth and moved faster and faster. Having his cock in her cunt and her tongue in his mouth drove her out of her mind with pleasure. She felt a great spasm of joy shake her, so violent that it was like falling off a horse and hitting the ground. It made her cry out loud. She opened her eyes and looked into his eyes and said his name. And then another wave took her, and another. And then she felt his body convulse, and he cried out too. And she felt a hot jet spurt inside her, and that inflamed her even more, so that she shook with pleasure again and again, so many times that she lost count, until at last the feeling began to fade, and gradually she went limp and still. She was too exhausted to speak or move, but she could feel Jack's weight slumped on top of her, his bony hips on hers, his flat chest squashing her soft breasts, his mouth close to her ear, his fingers entwined in her hair. A part of her mind thought vaguely, "That's what it's supposed to be like between men and women. That's why everyone makes so much fuss about it. That's why husbands and wives love one another so much." Jack's breathing became light and regular, and his body relaxed until it was completely limp. He was asleep. She turned her head and kissed his face. He was not too heavy. She wanted him to stay there asleep on top of her forever. That thought made her remember. Today was her wedding day. "Dear God," she thought, "what have I done?" She began to cry. After a moment, Jack woke up. He kissed the tears on her cheeks with unbearable tenderness. She said, "Oh, Jack, I want to marry you." "Then that's what we'll do," he said, in a voice of profound satisfaction. He had misunderstood her, and that made it even worse. "But we can't," she said, and her tears flowed faster. "But after this—"
"I know!
After this you must marry me."
"We can't marry," she said. "I've lost all my money, and you've got nothing."
He raised himself on his elbows. "I've got my hands," he said fiercely. "I'm the best stone carver for miles around."
"You are dismissed."
"It makes no difference. I could get work on any building site in the world." She shook her head miserably.
"It's not enough. I have to think about Richard."
"Why?" he said indignantly. "What has all this got to do with Richard? He can take care of himself." Suddenly Jack looked boyish, and Aliena felt the difference in their ages. He was 5 years younger than she, and he still thought he had a right to be happy. She said, "I swore an oath to my father when he was dying that I would look after Richard until he becomes Earl of Shiring." "But that could be never. But an oath is an oath." Jack looked nonplussed. He rolled off her. His soft penis slipped out of her, and she experienced a sense of loss like a pain. "I will never feel him inside me again," she thought sorrowfully. He said, "You can't mean this. An oath is just words. It's nothing by comparison with this. This is real. This is you and me." He looked at her breasts. Then he reached out and stroked the curly hair between her legs. It was so poignant that she felt his touch like a whiplash. He saw her wince and stopped. For a moment she was on the edge of saying, "Yes, all right, let's run away together now," and perhaps if he had carried on stroking her like that, she would have. But reason returned, and she said, "I'm going to marry Alfred. Don't be ridiculous. It's the only way." He stared at her. "I just don't believe you," he said.
"It's true.
I can't give you up. I can't. I can't." His voice cracked and he stifled a sob. She tried reason, arguing with herself as much as with him. "What's the point of breaking my vow to my father in order to make a marriage vow to you? If I break the first vow, the second is worthless." "I don't care. I don't want your vows. I just want us to be together all the time and make love whenever we feel like it." It was an 18-year-old view of marriage, she thought, but she did not say so. She would have accepted it gladly if she had been free. "I can't do what I want," she said sadly. "It's not my destiny." "What you're doing is wrong," he said. "I mean, evil. To give up happiness like this is like throwing jewels into the ocean. It's far worse than any sin." She was unexpectedly struck by the thought that her mother would have agreed with that. She was not sure how she knew. She dismissed the idea.
I could never be happy, even with you, if I had to live with the knowledge that I had broken my promise to my father.
You care more for your father and your brother than you do for me, he said, sounding faintly petulant for the first time.
No. What then?
He was just being argumentative, but she considered the question seriously.
I suppose it means that my oath to my father is more important to me than my love for you.
Is it?
He said incredulously.
Is it really?
Yes, it is, she said with a heavy heart, and her words sounded to her like a funeral bell.
Then there's nothing more to be said.
Only that I'm sorry. He got to his feet. He turned his back to her and picked up his undershirt. She looked at his long, slender body. There was a lot of curly red-gold hair on his legs. He put on his shirt and tunic quickly, then pulled up his socks and stepped into his boots. It all happened much too quickly.
You're going to be fearfully unhappy, he said. He was trying to be nasty to her, but the attempt was a failure, for she could hear compassion in his voice.
Yes, I am, she said. Would you at least say you respect me for my decision?
No, he said without hesitation. I don't. I despise you for it.
She sat there naked, looking at him, and she began to weep.
I might as well go, he said, and his voice cracked on the last word.
Yes. Go, she sobbed. He went to the door.
Jack!
He turned at the door. She said,
Wish me luck, Jack.
He lifted the bar.
Good.
He stopped, unable to speak. He looked down at the floor, then up at her again. This time his voice came out in a whisper.
Good luck, he said.
Then he went out. The house that had been Tom's house was now Ellen's, but it was also Alfred's home, so this morning it was full of people preparing a wedding feast organized by Martha, Alfred's 13-year-old sister, with Jack's mother looking on disconsolately. Alfred was there with a towel in his hand, about to go down to the river. Women bathed once a month, and men at Easter and Michaelmas, but it was traditional to bathe on your wedding morning. The place went quiet when Jack walked in. Alfred said, What do you want?
I want you to call off the wedding, Jack replied.
Piss off, Alfred said.
Jack realized he had started badly. He should try not to make a confrontation out of this. What he was proposing was in Alfred's interest, too, if only he could be made to see it.
Alfred, she doesn't love you, he said as gently as he could.
You don't know anything about it, laddie.
I do, Jack persisted. She doesn't love you. She's marrying you for Richard's sake. He's the only one who will be made happy by this marriage.
Go back to the monastery, Alfred said contemptuously. Where's your habit, anyway?
Jack took a deep breath. There was nothing else for it but to tell him the real truth.
Alfred, she loves me.
He expected Alfred to be enraged, but instead the shadow of a sly grin appeared on Alfred's face. Jack was nonplussed. What did it mean? Gradually the explanation dawned on him.
You know that already, he said unbelievingly. You know she loves me.
And you don't care. You want her anyway, whether she loves you or not. You just want to have her. Alfred's furtive smile became more visible and more malicious, and Jack knew that everything he was saying was true. But there was something else, something more, to be read in Alfred's face. An incredible suspicion arose in Jack's mind.
Why do you want her? He said.
Is it? Could it be that you only want to marry her to take her away from me? His voice rose in anger.
That you're marrying her out of spite?
A look of cunning triumph spread across Alfred's stupid face, and Jack knew that he was right again. He was devastated. The idea that Alfred was doing all this not out of an understandable lust for Aliena, but out of pure malice was too much to bear.
Damn you! You'd better treat her right! He yelled.
Alfred laughed. The ultimate malignity of Alfred's purpose struck Jack like a blow. Alfred
was not going to treat her well. That would be his final revenge on Jack. Alfred was going to marry Aliena and make her miserable.
"You filth," Jack said bitterly. "You slime, you shit, you ugly, stupid, evil, loathsome slug."
His contempt finally got to Alfred, who dropped his towel and came at Jack with his hand balled into a fist. Jack was ready for him and stepped forward to hit him first. Then Jack's mother was between them, and despite being smaller than either of them, she stopped them with a word. "Alfred, go and bathe." Alfred calmed down quickly. He realized he had won the day without needing to fight Jack, and his thoughts revealed themselves in a smug look. He left the house. Mother said, "What are you going to do, Jack?" Jack found that he was shaking with rage. He breathed in and out several times before he could speak. He could not stop the wedding, he realized, but he could not watch it either. "I have to leave Kingsbridge." He saw sorrow cross her face, but she nodded. "I was afraid you'd say that. But I think you're right." A bell began to ring in the priory. Jack said, "Any moment now they'll discover that I've escaped." She lowered her voice. "Go quickly, but hide down by the river within sight of the bridge. I'll bring you some things." "All right." He turned away. Martha stood between him and the door with tears pouring down her face. He hugged her. She squeezed him hard. Her girlish body was flat and bony like a boy's.
"Come back one day," she said fiercely.
He kissed her once quickly and went out. There were plenty of people about now, fetching water and enjoying the mild autumn morning. Most people knew he had become a novice monk. The town was still small enough for everyone to know everyone else's business, and his layman's clothing drew surprised looks, although nobody actually questioned him. He went quickly down the hill, crossed the bridge, and walked along the bank of the river until he came to a clump of reeds. He crouched down beside the reeds and watched the bridge, waiting for his mother. He had no idea where he was going to go. Perhaps he would walk in a straight line until he came to a town where they were building a cathedral and stop there. He had meant what he said to Aliena about finding work. He knew he was good enough to be employed anywhere. Even if the site had a full complement, he would only have to show the master builder how he could carve and he would get taken on. But there seemed no point to it any more. He would never love another woman after Aliena, and he felt much the same about Kingsbridge Cathedral. He wanted to build here, not just anywhere. Perhaps he would just walk into the forest and lie down and die. That seemed to him a nice idea. It was mild weather, the trees were green and gold. He could make a peaceful end. His only regret would be that he had not found out more about his father before he died. He was picturing himself lying on a bed of autumn leaves and passing gently into death when he saw Mother cross the bridge. She was leading a horse. He got to his feet and ran to her. The horse was the chestnut mare she always rode. "I want you to take my mare," she said. He took her hand and squeezed it by way of thanks. Tears came to her eyes. "I never did look after you very well," she said. "First I brought you up wild in the forest. Then I let you nearly starve with Tom. Then I made you live with Alfred." "You looked after me fine, Mother," he said. "I made love to Aliena this morning. Now I can die happy."
"You foolish boy," she said. "You're just like me. If you can't have the lover you want, you won't have anyone else."
"Is that how you are?" he said. She nodded.
"After your father died, I lived alone, rather than take second best. I never wanted another man until I saw Tom. That was 11 years later."
She detached her hand from his.
"I'm telling you this for a reason. It may take 11 years, but you will love someone else one day. I promise you."
He shook his head. "It doesn't seem possible."
"I know."
She looked nervously back over her shoulder at the town.
"You'd better go."
He walked over to the horse. It was loaded with 2 bulging saddlebags.
"What's in the bags?" he asked.
"Some food and money and a full wineskin in this one," she replied. The other contains Tom's tools. Jack was moved. Mother had insisted on keeping Tom's tools after he died as a memento. Now she was passing them on to him. He hugged her.